It's time.
We are not called to be nice.
Sandy Rios, welcome, Sandy. Thanks for being here.
We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
And you still like me, or you don't like me, James?
Are you okay? You're all right.
I'm a musician. I can't help it.
Longtime Fox News contributor Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
We have, I think it's 4 to 1 youth in America wants gay marriage.
Our kids are the product of public schools. No wonder they poll the way they do.
It's time to stand up or we're going to lose everything we have.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up, speak up, say something, do something.
This isn't a game. This is real life.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
Some things are worth fighting for.
Gun rights supporters flooded into downtown Richmond to demonstrate against new gun control laws under consideration by Virginia state lawmakers.
AR-15, this is a Glock 20.
George, who did not want to give us his last name, says he drove from Michigan to participate in Monday's rally. He, like many people, proudly marched while showing off their gun collection.
Just want to show people that we are all here supporting the Second Amendment.
Virginia's Democratic-controlled legislature is considering several new laws, among them limiting handgun purchases to only one every month, enacting universal background checks for gun purchases, and allowing local governments to ban guns from some public spaces. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has made gun control a top priority of his administration.
I bet you nobody here is going to comply with any of the laws he's going to pass.
Law enforcement remained on high alert during Monday's rally as officials feared hate groups would show up to create chaos. In response, Northam declared an emergency last week, banning weapons from being brought onto State House grounds.
State intelligence analysts have identified threats and violent rhetoric similar to what has been seen before other major events, such as Charlottesville.
The Virginia Citizens Defense League organized today's rally. Its leader says his group's only goal was to defend the Second Amendment and that the rally had nothing to do with hate.
The governor declared war on gun owners, law-abiding gun owners, and that activated grassroots gun owners across the state in a way I've never seen before.
Tonight, the governor is praising law enforcement for de-escalating what he says could have been a volatile situation. Police estimate some 22,000 people showed up here for the rally, and they say only one person was arrested.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. I had to follow up on the gun rally in Virginia yesterday in Richmond because we talked about it so much, and I was excited to see, I'm telling you, American patriots descend on that Capitol. Remember, Governor Northam actually put up a fence cordoning off the Capitol, the Virginia State Capitol. And so most people had to stay outside of that fence. A lot of people called in, or a few people called in yesterday, worried about going, which was discouraging to me, because if there had not been a good turnout, trust me, people who want to take your guns away all over the country had their eyes on Richmond yesterday. And that was, believe me, a gut punch for them that 22,000 people showed up and there was only one arrest. How very disappointing to Governor Northam and the people working with him, like Michael Bloomberg and others, who want to take away the Second Amendment right to bear and carry arms, and who failed at making this a racist issue, a white supremacist issue, which is what they desperately want to do. And I want to illustrate that by one of the attendees yesterday was interviewed. I want you to hear what he has to say. This is clip 3.
The reason I'm out here is I do not support in any way, shape, or form Governor Northam's and the Democrats' gun control. What I also don't support is the fact that every news piece you've seen on this weekend, they've always brought up the issue of race as though it's nothing but white rednecks and hillbillies out here who care for the Second Amendment. When actually, Black Americans, Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, Americans in general care about the Second Amendment. I work at a gun store part-time, and I can't tell you the number of customers I see of all races, all colors, all creeds, who care about the Second Amendment and who just want to peaceably live their lives, enjoy their rights, and the Second Amendment. So that's why I'm out here. And big media, mainstream media be If you take a good look at me, you can see I'm a black American. And all I'm out here for is to enjoy my Second Amendment rights. That's why I'm here.
Great. And what, tell us about, what do you think about the cordoning off that's going on out here of the capital area?
What I honestly think about it is, it's wrong. This is our capital. We pay for these grounds. This is not someplace for the king to hold up in. This is our capital. This is our state. We have the right to petition for redress of our government, of our grievances. And our grievance today is their treatment of us and the Second Amendment. So the fact that he's got to hide behind fences like he's the king in Braveheart, I think is complete and utter garbage.
Great.
All right, so that was an attendee yesterday. There were chants of USA, USA all over the place. 22,000. I wish I had been there. Man, if I could have gone, I would have been there. And I'm so proud of many of you who took that. After all of those warnings and scare tactics, some of you didn't go. That was disappointing to me, I have to tell you. I wanted you to go. And so many of you did. I heard from Margie from Goochland Tea Party. I know a lot of the Goochland Tea Party went down there. And Margie actually sent a link to some wonderful pictures from the rally. Really wonderful pictures from the Virginia Citizens Defense League. I think they took them from one of the local news sources in Richmond. And so we'll put this on our Facebook page. I think you would enjoy seeing those. The one arrest was a woman who had a mask on. And they demanded that she take it off, and she wouldn't. So that was the one violent moment. I'm quote-unquote violent. Lots of sheriffs were out there. And, of course, you know that the sheriffs are duly elected. They're not appointed. And they're political in the sense that they answer to the people. But the sheriffs are really taking the front line on this. And one of them is Grayson County Sheriff Richard Vaughn, who said this, clip 5.
Or city or commonwealth still be...
If the bills go through as proposed, they will not be enforced. They're unconstitutional. We swore to uphold the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of Virginia, and that's what we'll do.
Outstanding.
Yeah.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So, you know, he was very eloquent. He had a lot of other things to say. That was, again, the sheriff from Grayson County, Sheriff Richard Vaughn. He wasn't the only one who spoke out. I have so many clips, I can't play them all. But let me just say the 136 Virginia jurisdictions have declared themselves sanctuaries out from the Second Amendment rights infringements that Governor Northam and the Assembly plan to pass. And keep in mind, if you say, well, that's just the same as the asylum cities for illegal immigrants, you're breaking the law. That's not true. These guys are claiming asylum or sanctuary status for it is constitutional. It supersedes whatever things that the Virginia Legislature Assembly may try to do to stop their constitutional rights. So what they're doing is perfectly lawful. What the Virginia authorities and many around the country are trying to do to take away America's right to bear arms is unconstitutional, not lawful. So there's a very big difference. Okay, well, there's a lot more to say about that, but I want to move on to something that's kind of important, and that is that today the impeachment, the president is the movement to the Senate has begun. And last night, Mitch McConnell introduced his resolution with that timeline for the Senate trial. And it's going to be starting Thursday, I believe. Both sides, Democrats and Republicans, will be given 24 hours to argue their case over the course of 2 days. So my understanding is that they can't start until the afternoon because John Roberts, the Chief Justice, is the presiding officer in the Senate in an impeachment trial. And he has his regular duties, so he can't come until like 1 o'clock. That's when they're going to gavel in. So it's going to be 12-hour days for the next 4 days for these senators. And that's going to be interesting because they're not young anymore, and I've not seen with my own eye their willingness to really work that hard. So that's really interesting. Now, we mentioned that early there had been speculation, the rules were just released last night, that there would be what some are calling the kill switch. What McConnell was proposing. And as I understand it, my understanding today, there seems to be some wiggle room here that there is a way for the Republicans to call an end to this if the Democrats, if it gets out of hand and it becomes a circus like the Kavanaugh hearing. That's as simply as I know how to put it. And so I hope that that's true. We know that, meanwhile, the president has appointed 8 members of the House of Representatives to be part of his impeachment team. That was announced last night, too. So let me tell you who they are. I think you're going to be happy about this. I'm happy about this. I like all of these guys, two girls. Jim Jordan, John Ratcliffe, Mark Meadows, Mike Johnson, Elsie Stefanik, Lee Zeldin, Doug Collins, and Debbie Lesko. All of them were stars in the impeachment process in the House in the sense that they fought back, fought. The one name that's not here that is curious is Matt Gaetz. So I don't know why Matt's not on there. It's a shame he isn't, because he's certainly one of the president's most fierce advocates. But those are the eight members of the House that will be helping the president through this process. And, of course, all eight of them know the inside and out of what the case is that was brought by the Democrats in the House. They know its holes. They know its flaws. And so they will be great members of this team. I saw the president. He's in Davos, Switzerland this morning to start this economic process. It's night there, morning for us. He gave a speech this morning. My observation looking at him is I felt he looked very tired. He discouraged, tired, burdened, you know, fill in the blanks. I would say that the president has asked us to pray, the whole country, pray over this impeachment. He's asked for that. And so let's do that, all right? We need to pray for him and his family. We need to pray for the members of the Senate as they deliberate this. We need to play for a peaceful order as this thing unfolds, for it to be handled in a way that our Constitution has laid out, which is orderly, respectfully, and fairly, that justice will be done. And I got this, I don't even know this person that sent this email. I don't even know how I got it, but it is so good that I'm going to share it with you. I hardly ever catch an email of someone I don't know, because my inbox, I've got, I don't know, over 100,000 easily. And I just I can't read things that I can't identify with. I could never get through it. But this, she basically says, our republic is under a threat. And I'm requesting each of you to reach out to your spheres of influence, asking all of those who know to call their senators now, as well as each of you personally, your senator. Party doesn't matter, but the call or the email does. It's very simple. If we stand behind President Trump and are expecting your vote to acquit, we are standing behind President Trump and expect your vote to acquit our president. It's time to get back to the business of moving America forward. That's the message that she is recommending. By the way, it's Dr. Carla Dean Graves. Dr. Graves, I don't know who you are, but I like this. And she says it's not difficult. And she said, President Trump has been and continues to be there for us. Now it is our turn to be there for him. It is necessary. Why? Because our legislators need to know the American people are still here and engaged in their government that is not only for the people, but by the people. As President Reagan said, if not us, then who? If not now, then when? Step up and make that call now. We have an opportunity to be heard, so speak. You see why I like that, don't you? And I didn't want to take credit. I should have said that myself, but I just wanted to use her words. I thought she put it beautifully. She said, as it says in the book of James, you have not because you ask not. And so the challenge is for us to call our senators today and ask them to vote to acquit our president and get on with the business, that we support him and we want this to stop. And maybe if I tell you this next part, you'll understand why that's so important. CNN came out with a poll, they say. The headline is 51% say the Senate should remove President Trump from office. 51%. And they break it down. Now, stay with me now. Don't tune off right now. Don't turn down the dial. Listen to the rest of what I have to say. They say about half of Americans say the Senate should vote to convict President Donald Trump and remove him from office in the upcoming impeachment trial. 45% say the Senate should vote against conviction and removal. Nearly 7 in 10 say that the upcoming trial should feature testimony from new witnesses who did not testify in the House impeachment inquiry. And it goes on and on. It says the new poll also finds majorities of Americans view each of the charges on which Trump will face as true. So you read through all of this and then you get to the end and guess how they polled. It was a telephone poll. It was random. They didn't know who people were, not even if they were citizens. They didn't know if they were Republicans or Democrats. They don't know if they're from California or New York State or Alabama. I wonder who they did call. I wonder which state. I wonder which population area. I just wonder. 1,156 adults randomly called. That is a meaningless poll, and yet they will use it to shape the views of those listening to their outlet today. It'll be on there all day long. So remember, this is a bogus poll used to influence your thought about the impeachment. Don't go away. Really a great guest coming up. Sandy Rios in the morning, AFR Talk.
The Word of God truly comforts, doesn't it? Hi, it's Michael Woolworth with Bible League International, engaging the world with the hope of God's Word for more than 80 years at only $5 a Bible. You know, we serve the under-resourced church all over the globe, and that includes those persecuted simply because they believe Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And as I meet with these heroes of the faith, not once do they ask me to pray for an end to their persecution, because they know that God is working through this suffering, He's strengthening their faith, and He's bringing many to Himself. And what they're asking for is the ability to endure, and you do that when you have a Bible. I was in Psalm 139 this morning. It says, Lord, you know all about me. You know when I rise up, when I sit down, everywhere I go, you know everything about me. And I thought, if you're persecuted, you need to be able to read that Bible verse. Amen. Hey, would you learn how to be a blessing in this kingdom work by visiting sendbiblesnow.org? That's sendbiblesnow.org, or call Bible League at 800-YES-WORD. 800-YES-WORD.
Blind Eyes Opened, a Christian documentary exposing the sex trafficking industry and highlighting survivors' transformations through Christ.
It's happening somewhere right now.
We oftentimes turn a blind eye.
Our children are being used for the commercial sex trade.
The United States of America is one of the largest consumers of human trafficking.
You have no idea what a sex trafficked victim's life is like.
At the Planned Parenthood facility where I work, so I was having them sign these consent forms, sometimes for their 16th, 17th abortion procedure.
Where is God in all of this? And God immediately replies, where are you?
Committed to ending the atrocities while showing Christ as the hope for all involved. More information is available at blindeyesopened.com. That's blindeyesopened.com. Parental discretion is strongly advised.
Hello, Americans. I'm Todd Starnes with news and commentary next. Liberty University is preparing students to enter a competitive job market. They have a low student-to-professor ratio, a caring Christian faculty, and more than 550 programs of study, ranging from undergraduate certificates to doctoral degrees. As the largest Christian university in the world, Liberty continues to establish itself as both a leading liberal arts university and an institution dedicated to the Christian faith. Learn more at liberty.edu. That's liberty.edu. Minnesota's 2019 Teacher of the Year hates America. Her name is Kelly Holstein. She was among a number of state teachers of the year honored at the college football championship game. Ms. Holstein was given a place of honor on the field at the Superdome. But during the national anthem, the school teacher took a knee. She literally dropped to a knee on the field, disrespecting the flag and our military. Ms. Holstein says she wanted to raise awareness about LGBT issues, but what she really did was bring great shame upon herself. It's real simple, folks. When the bombs are bursting in air, you stand at attention, hand over heart. This teacher is the poster child for everything that is wrong with public education. What concerns me most are the children who were in this teacher's care. If you hate America, you have no business being anywhere near a public school classroom. We cannot afford to allow our kids to be indoctrinated by leftist propagandists. I'm Todd Starnes.
Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
I love being a woman. When I say I love being a woman, I mean I love all of me. I mean, I love all that that means. My mind, my lips, my soul, my hips, my body, my fertility. Inner, outer beauty, and all that makes me she. We women are strong, intuitive, compassionate, and valuable. Smart, caring, nurturing, capable, and powerful. We are lawyers, mothers, poets, politicians, and teachers. Doctors, daughters, wives, artists, sisters, we are leaders. Let us always keep in our remembrance the bravery of our founding feminists. They birthed the 19th Amendment. Friends, these were our real-life heroines. Thank Alice Paul, because it was she who fought with Susan B. Anthony. In 1920, they got the vote, but it was just the beginning. They called abortion, and I quote, the ultimate exploitation of women. They not only recognize the rights of our very smallest children, they knew abortion at its core also harms us as women. Now come 2020, the number of killed females unborn has reached 30 million. But it should be no surprise that abortion targets the marginalized, so I'm lucky I survived. Let's go back in time again and find another heroine, Jane Roe of Roe v. Wade, the Supreme Court case that made abortion legal in all states. Jane Roe was a cover name. Roe's real name was Norma McCorvey. She said she firmly believes the entire abortion industry is based on a lie. She spent the rest of her life trying to undo the law that bears her name. This was Jane Roe of Roe v. Wade, the woman who fought for abortion in the first place. But by the time she realized the lie, they'd closed the case. We will never have true equality until we realize that abortion as a solution is the greatest lie. When we as women suffer costs like childcare or poverty, it should never even be the slightest thought that we'd terminate a life to solve the problems of society. Instead of hurting mothers most vulnerable, why would we not stand up with them and affirm their right to be assisted with injustice when in a crisis pregnancy? Because the power we have now and the rights that were afforded us are because of great women rising up before us. They took single cries and turned them into a chorus saying, "We will not be silenced and you cannot ignore us." Ladies, let's fight like them to be a voice for the voiceless.
All right, Sandy Rios with you. You might say, I guess, that the March for Life, which is taking place in Washington, D.C., this Friday is the real Women's March. You'll see hundreds of thousands of women and babies and, of course, husbands and fathers and brothers marching. It is one of my favorite events in Washington. When I was president of Concerned Women for America, the first march that came along in January, I dismissed my entire staff. We were busy working and thinking. We wrote think pieces. We helped shape thought on many issues, including life. It felt very much to me like we needed to close down shop and go out and actually march, put our pedal to the metal, put our actual physical bodies in the fight. And that's what we did. And that's what started it for me. I love the march. If you're anywhere near Washington, and even if you aren't, I've been known to jump in a car and drive 12 hours just to get there. You should be there because you will be so encouraged. It is the most joyful experience that you'll ever have in D.C. And it's the most joyful experience of an event that takes place in Washington that's so huge that no one wants to cover. So if you really want to see it and really want to find out what happens, you need to see it with your own eyes. This March for Life on Friday will be the 47th anniversary of the passage of Roe versus Wade. That is the marker. You heard in that clip, which was put together by the March for Life, that Roe versus Wade was the decision in the Supreme Court in 1973 that made abortion legal. What you may not know is the companion companion decision to that, which is Doe versus Bolton, made abortion legal for all 9 months. This was 1973. This was stunning because the Americans were not ready for this. This was an activist court who decided for all of us that abortion would be legal. And since that time, over 60 million babies have been aborted in the United States. All right, so the march takes place this Friday, and I wanted to talk about this today because I wanted to give you time to pack your bags or make a plan and get to D.C., even if you don't spend the night there, because it is expensive in D.C., but you can find hotels in other areas that are out from the D.C. area a little bit, or you can just drive back home, you know, just to take the plunge. It's really quite an adventure. I'll tell you someone that's taken the plunge, and he's taken a very long plunge, and that's Dr. Callum Miller. Callum is a medical doctor from the UK. He's a research fellow at the Oxford Center of Christian Apologetics, and I'm going to tell you a whole lot more about him in a second, but I want to introduce him. He has come to D.C. this week for the march, and he joins us this morning. Good morning, Dr. Miller.
Good morning, Sandy. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Why in the world would you, a Brit, come to the American March for Life? Why are you doing that?
Well, good question. Firstly, because as you say, I've been told it's just an amazing experience, regardless of anything else. But secondly, what I'm kind of come over to do this January is set up a series of meetings with people, really trying to equip people and inform people about the global pro-life movement and trying to get support. So actually, kind of say to people, here's what you could do overseas. There are a huge number of people all over the world who are pro-life. We estimate from polling that the large majority of the world's population is pro-life, and certainly most countries in the world have generally pro-life laws. And so what we really wanted to do was to come over and let people know what there is to be done overseas, because actually a lot of these countries, despite being very pro-life, are under enormous political pressure to introduce abortion, which we know will lead to the loss of, you know, millions and millions of lives, and will also hurt millions and millions of women. And so what we're doing really is just exploring the global pro-life movement, learning from America, since it's been involved in this so long and at such a high level, and really equipping people to let them know what they can do overseas, because there really is such a huge potential to save millions of lives overseas if we begin this kind of battle as soon as possible.
Yeah, I want to talk about that in more detail in a second. You know, one thing, can I call you Callum? Is that all right if I do that? Is that disrespectful?
Of course, yeah. All right.
I don't mean to be. I just, one thing that I watched with my own eyes was, in our American headlines, we have had this whole quid pro quo Latin phrase, you know, in front of us, accusing our president. I don't want to make this a political discussion about him. I want to make a point about him allegedly withholding aid from Ukraine so the Ukraine would investigate its corruption, and the left alleges because it would help him get reelected. Some of us reject that. But the point is, they're accusing him of what's called quid pro quo. I had a front row seat to the Clinton administration, and I would say the American feminists and the Canadian feminists, but the Americans had the power and the money, withholding aid from countries that would not adopt abortion practices. They did it in South America. They did it in Africa. So there was absolutely lots of quid pro quo going on during the Clinton administration, and so abortion was exported amazingly. I don't know if you know anything about that, Dr. Miller, but if you do, I would love to know what your thoughts are about how you've seen that the influence, international influence on Europe and other nations of the world in advocating abortion.
Yes, well, yeah, I mean, I can't name names or anything, but certainly, you know, diplomats I've spoken to from developing countries, very pro-life countries, have said, you know, there's a huge fear that there'll be the withdrawal of aid. It's unclear exactly how explicitly that has been made in the past, but certainly speaking to many different diplomats, there is an overwhelming sense that the pressure of needing aid money really does force people to introduce these sorts of legislation. And so that is a huge effect that we do see, however formalized it is. And so one of the things we, of course, want to do is kind of make the international aid process more transparent and give these countries whistleblowing protection against that sort of pressure, because we really feel that that would empower these countries not only to stand up for their own born, but also just to stand up for themselves against this sort of colonial bullying. So I absolutely agree that this is a huge element of the debate internationally.
One thing I did not, or at least I want to talk about, again, your own bio, which is very impressive. Dr. Miller, you are a research fellow at the Oxford Center of Christian Apologetics, but you are also a medical doctor in Great Britain. You graduated from the University of Oxford Medical School. You currently work as a doctor in the UK, as I said. You're a research associate at the University of Oxford. You focus on ethics, and I want to get into that too. There's so much to get into. You also have your master's degree in biblical studies. Lots of interesting things that would intersect with a discussion with us. But let's get real personal for a second. You're a doctor in the UK. So I honestly don't know what the laws are, the specific laws in Great Britain about abortion. Is abortion illegal for all 9 months for any reason in Great Britain?
No. So we have a limit of 24 weeks for any reason. And officially, the reason is that you have to say the pregnancy is a greater risk to the woman's physical or mental health and continuing the pregnancy, but this in effect works out to being abortion on demand up to 24 weeks. After 24 weeks, we have abortion only if the mother's life is at risk or there's a risk of serious permanent injury, or if the child has any sort of disability. Now, that doesn't need to be a serious disability. It can be something like cleft palate. We know about 10 children each year are aborted in the UK because they have cleft palate, and that's legal up to birth and, in fact, during birth in the UK. We don't know if partial birth abortion happens in the UK, but it's certainly legal. And there was a bid to outlaw it back in the 90s, which failed in Parliament. And of course, the kind of the life-saving clause itself is somewhat flexibly interpreted. We don't see a widespread abuse of it. We don't see huge numbers of children being aborted after 24 weeks. But we do know that some of those abortions, which could take place after 24 weeks, the reason given for them being life-saving is that they are for mental disorder or something like that, when we know that abortion doesn't actually solve any mental disorder or, in fact, contribute to better mental health outcomes. So there's a little bit of flexibility, but generally we don't see a huge number of very late abortions, even though it is legal for certain cases.
How does that affect you as a physician? I would think, you know, now I do know that, okay, this is a whole different issue. I don't expect you to comment on this, but the whole issue of the LGBT and gender transition and all that, some doctors in the UK have gotten in trouble for speaking out against that. But how about the issue of life? Do you find that you are kind of first of all, you certainly must not be forced to perform abortions. That's kind of a question statement. But the second thing is, how does it affect you as a pro-life doctor in the UK?
Yeah, good question. Yes, you're right. We have statutory protection at the moment so that we don't have to perform abortions. But there are kind of limits to how much this involvement means. So doctors generally are still obliged to refer patients onwards for abortions, even if they don't think there's a clinical reason for the abortion, even if they think it's just medically not the right thing, and they can back that up with evidence. We know that some nurses have been taken to court, and I think it went to the Supreme Court in the end, and were basically told that overseeing kind of the ward where abortions were taking place and contributing to abortion taking place in that way was not legally protected. So there's a bit of, you know, ambiguity in the law, but certainly we don't have to take part in them directly in that sense. In terms of what it's like to be a doctor, certainly I'm in a very small minority, and the kind of the vocal minority is even smaller. So there are very few people who really will speak about this publicly in the UK. I've actually been surprised at how lenient people have been and how kind of willing to hear people out they have been. So I have, you know, managed to speak about this in a wide variety of contexts, in certain medical contexts, and generally people are willing to listen. And there is a broad freedom of kind of speech when it comes to this issue in the UK, even among doctors. But of course, you know, we have to be careful with what we say. We can't say everything that we'd like to in every context. And there are occasions when there is kind of a huge level of vitriol given out. So recently I was on the BBC program, a very large daytime BBC kind of talk show speaking about abortion. And all I did was describe what an abortion in the second trimester involved. And I had so many doctors, very senior ones in some cases, a huge number of doctors on Twitter sending me abuse, telling me that I shouldn't be a doctor, saying they were writing to our professional body to try and get me struck off, and so on. Now, that didn't come to anything because I think the professional body, in that respect, is much more sensible than many of these doctors. But certainly there is that pressure, and we might well see it growing in future years. And certainly it is possible to get in trouble. We did have a student midwife just a few months ago who was suspended from her course at her university, basically because she was pro-life. So we are beginning to see a much more kind of expanded intolerance of pro-life people in healthcare settings and at the university levels as well.
Yes, I was really curious, and I am curious, about how that plays out at Oxford. You know, Dr. Miller, we are enduring here, it's almost incomprehensible wave of lack of tolerance on our universities. They're just actually going off the cliff in terms of intellectually, in terms of reason and logic, in terms of the ability to debate, which is, you know, a great tradition of the Brits, as well as we've inherited that from you. No debate at all. That's not the truth. I don't know how you could work at Oxford, I guess. Are you not experiencing that same thing in Great Britain?
Well, we do have considerable problems with academic freedom, and certainly we face, you know, precisely the same challenges as in the US, only we don't have a First Amendment. we can't take as much legal recourse.
Dr. Miller, I'm going to interrupt you. Let me interrupt you. Dr. Miller, let me interrupt you. I'm sorry, because the music is playing, and I want you to be able to give a good answer to that. So we'll come back with that. And then I also want to ask you about the effect of the EU, maybe the effect of Brexit on some of these things that have been instilled, like in Ireland, and then across the globe as you see it, just the the state of things globally and the issue of protecting a life, the effect of Planned Parenthood International from your perspective. My guest is Dr. Callum Miller. He's a medical doctor in the UK. He's a research fellow at the Oxford Center of Christian Apologetics and also just a researcher, a research associate at the University of Oxford. We'll be back right after this. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. My name is Abraham Hamilton III, and this is the Hamilton Minute. Sometimes there's a delay between crying out to God in prayer and seeing those prayers answered. It is imperative for us in those times that we don't waver in our confidence in our God. The next verse goes on to say, "For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what is promised." You see, the delay between supplication and delivered answer is one of the ways God develops endurance in us. He desires that the roots of our faith grow down deep, that we become trees planted by rivers of living water, steadfast, immovable, always abounding in His work. In this, we grow beyond superficial Christianity.
Listen each weekday from 5 to 6 p.m. Central for the Hamilton Corner with Abraham Hamilton III, public policy analyst for the American Family Association.
Airing the Addisons.
The enemy, you know, doesn't even care enough to have anything fresh in the attack against us.
Mm-hmm.
It's like repackaged deception.
Bringing biblical perspective to issues affecting the church and the family.
So we have battled against secularism and we've won. And why? Not because we're so great, but because the Lord Jesus Christ made a promise to the church that the gates of hell shall not prevail against her.
Yes.
Airing the Addisons, weekday afternoons, 2 to 3 Central on American Family Radio.
Bishop E.W. Jackson.
A lot of people have become convinced that somehow America is an evil nation, a racist nation, an oppressive nation, a sexist nation, blah, 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 blah.
The Awakening.
I say God bless America and thank God for America because the whole world is a better place because America exists.
Weekdays at noon Central on American Family Radio.
We're all that we claim to be as a nation and more.
Brian Fisher here with today's Life and Liberty Minute. The Supreme Court will hear a case on so-called faithless electors, electors who don't vote the way they're supposed to. The truth is, the founders designed a system in which each state gets a certain number of votes based on their population, and the states choose the presidents through electors, people they believe they can trust to cast wise votes for them. When we vote in November, we will not be voting for a president, but for electors to represent us when the Electoral College casts the only votes that actually count in a presidential election. According to the Founders' Constitution, once the people have chosen their electors in November, those electors can vote for anyone they choose. States have no legal authority to control them or to compel them to vote a certain way. Let's hope the court applies the Constitution the way the founders wrote it.
Catch Brian Fisher on Focal Point, weekday afternoons at 105 Central on American Family Radio.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. In today's war for the free world, a key front line is the Western Pacific, where Communist China's ambition to be the globe's dominant power is much in evidence. It's fortified man-made islands in the South China Sea, intensifying crackdown in Hong Kong. Political warfare in Australia and naval buildup are ominous harbingers of trouble to come. Particularly worrying is the Chinese Communist Party's harsh response to Taiwanese voters' recent overwhelming support for their island's sovereignty and freedoms. Beijing is signaling its determination to use force to crush both. The woman who won a massive mandate for opposing such Chinese threats, Taiwanese President Tsai Ing-wen, has a powerful message to the PRC: get over it. Quote, "Taiwan is an independent country already," unquote. That is, of course, both true, morally right, and in America's vital interest. We must deter China and stand with free Taiwan. This is Frank Gaffney.
Don't forget to connect with Sandy Rios in the morning on Facebook or email Sandy at sandy@afr.net. That's sandy@afr.net. Sandy Rios in the morning on American Family Radio.
It was the scale of the victory which surprised. On a question so personal, so anguished for both sides, no one had been quite sure how it would go. But in the grounds of Dublin Castle today, The day belonged to the Yes campaign.
I know I look like I'm miserable, but I'm just really happy. I'm sorry. Sorry.
And what do you think it says about Ireland?
That we're finally in 2018, that we treat women the same, because before this we were second-class citizens, we didn't have bodily autonomy, and we're finally equal.
There were a lot of predictions that it would be women who would vote yes but men no, it would be younger people who would vote yes but older people not.
Everybody voted. You know, 70% of this country who voted voted for a repeal.
And a big change for Ireland?
Oh yeah, it's probably the most major social change in Ireland ever.
Repealing the Eighth Amendment, which enshrined in law the equal right to life of the unborn baby alongside its mother, brings to an end a 35-year constitutional ban on abortion.
All right, that happened in May of 2018, and that was Ireland, the last, certainly great part of Great Britain, to drop its restrictions on abortion. You heard how happy, how twisted the logic that women are finally equal because now they can kill their babies. That's the feminist influence on the world, and I do put that squarely on the shoulders of the Western feminists in America and the Canada. They've done a really good job of selling this nonsense that abortion, your right to kill your baby, has something to do with your own personal worth. It's just amazing. And I've watched the damage it's done to women. It's just the opposite. The damage it has done to women throughout these decades is amazing. And I think people are beginning to see that. It either makes you, now this is a broad generalization, depressed and sorry for a lifetime or mad and angry for a lifetime. It seems like there's no in between. That's my editorial remark, but my guest is the expert. Dr. Callum Miller is a medical doctor in Great Britain. He's a research fellow at the Oxford Center of Christian Apologetics. He's also a research associate at the University of Oxford. Dr. Miller, I was asking you before the break, you are in Oxford. We have almost no free speech on college campuses here now. That's probably an overstatement. At the Ivy League colleges, that's for sure. So how do you survive at Oxford, given your views on the sanctity of human life?
Well, we have the same problems in the UK as in the US, but we don't have a First Amendment, so we don't have as much legal recourse in that sense. But I think the problems so far are not quite as severe. The impression I get is that American universities are far more kind of authoritarian when it comes to free speech than the UK ones. There is a fair bit of pushback against this in the UK, and we do find that many people do actually support academic freedom and other freedoms, even if they don't agree with the pro-life view in the UK. But of course, there are still pressures. I think I have to say, actually, Oxford is one of the best universities that I've come across on this issue. They are very, very supportive of academic freedom in general. And I think part of that is because in bioethics, at the University of Oxford, we have several ethicists who support very controversial positions, things like saying that disabled people are not equal in their human rights to non-disabled people, people who support infanticide, and so on. And so because some of these bioethicists support what are actually very controversial and unpopular positions, they've also seen attempts to crack down on their free speech kind of on the other side of the ethical spectrum. Which means that, you know, as much as I really disagree with those views and think that they're of course horrific, they are actually very, very supportive of academic freedom, which for which I'm very grateful to them. In bioethics in Oxford, there's almost no one who agrees with me on these issues. But actually, I found most of them to be very sincere people and very open-minded people who really do want to give people a fair hearing and who do actually defend the pro-life society when it does get in trouble with the university.
I'm sorry, I'm laughing because of the irony. You know, what you've just expressed, of course, is the American First Amendment, our right to free speech, to say what, you know, to criticize King George, as it were, to say what we want to say, as long as it doesn't incite violence or, you know, cause death. But our opinions, we have a right to express them, and now we are experiencing this rollback, and you guys are flourishing, it sounds like, at Oxford. I'm very grateful, I have to say. I mentioned Ireland, or we played that clip at the top of this segment. The EU, as I understand, has pressured the members of the EU states to embrace abortion. And they, I think they played a big role in what happened in Ireland. And if you disagree, say so. But I, but so now I find myself wondering if Brexit actually happens, which I haven't heard. It's been quite, we've been so filled with our own issues here in the States, it's taken our headlines. So I honestly don't know the state of that in this moment. I know that it's been, I know it's moving ahead, but I don't know the date. So what effect would that have, you think, on these moral issues in Great Britain?
Good question. Well, I guess the EU, yes, it does pressure countries from within the EU. It also pressures many, many countries outside the EU. And so it's kind of a global influence in favor of abortion, which is why many, I mean, it's not why most people in the UK voted to leave the EU, but it's certainly a big element of it for me personally. And so, yeah, certainly the EU does put a huge amount of pressure on states within it and outside it. I guess what I would say is that the countries in the EU do have a fair bit of discretion on it, and they are allowed to maintain their view. It's very hard for them, and it's hard for them to speak up publicly, and they get kind of criticized harshly when they do. But we do have countries like Malta. Well, Malta is now the only country in the EU that gives legal protection to unborn children, and that will turn into a debate gradually. We're seeing the beginnings of it now. And so strategically, keeping Malta pro-life is one of the big things we need to do in Europe, just to make sure that the EU has a different voice within it, to break that EU consensus and so on. So I think, you know, the UK leaving the EU will give it a bit more flexibility and a bit more leeway. But generally, the EU isn't so controlling as to affect the debates that will actually likely occur in the UK. I mean, in the UK, the main political debates are going to be things like banning sex-selective abortion, slightly lowering the gestation limits, giving women informed consent, perhaps on some issues, things like that. And the EU, of course, will try and fight those things, but it doesn't have much authority to do so, and it doesn't care about those as much as just more broadly abortion on demand up to a certain point. Because the UK actually is more liberal than most EU countries on abortion. The average in the EU, I think, is about 14 weeks gestation limit, whereas in the UK, it's 24 weeks. So the UK was actually one of the bad influences on the rest of the EU. And really, it's the Eastern European countries which are much, much better on this issue. And oh, they're the ones standing up for the EU.
That's interesting. Probably Poland, I'm guessing, right? I'm thinking Poland might be
Poland,
a leader
and,
in it.
Yes, yeah. And Hungary as well. Hungary has abortion legalized up to a certain point, but it doesn't like it. And the main reason Hungary still has it is because the people still broadly support abortion, and so they don't want to touch it politically. But certainly when it comes to speaking internationally, Hungary speaks up in defense of the family and in defense of unborn life. So they're very good as well. But pretty much Poland and Hungary are the only ones who are willing to really speak out against the EU on this issue.
You know, I remember back, 15 years ago maybe, South America, Africa, I remember some really strong pro-life leaders saying, why is America withholding aid? How can they force us to have abortions? African countries and ambassadors to the UN were saying that I can't even think of the name. We participated in the UN, whatever that word is. So it was just shocking to me that we were forcing them to embrace abortion, but we have been. And so you, in your presence in D.C. this week, and by the way, Dr. Miller is there for the March for Life, which is taking place this Friday. And let me say again, it is the 47th commemoration, or I guess mourning, over the passage of Roe versus Wade, which made abortion legal in this country. It was a shocking decision, shocking, shocking. And the companion decision made abortion legal for all 9 months. Perhaps you didn't know that, but it did. And the only reason we don't have that available in every state is because states stepped in to place restrictions. But it is still the law of the land that you should be able to get an abortion for all 9 months. Callum, you said in your the event that you were advertising, that outside the U.S., the rest of the world is crying out for pro-life voices. Put that in perspective, if you will. We've talked about Great Britain, and we can talk about it again, but are there pro-life pockets around where people are speaking out? What do you mean by that?
Sure. Well, I guess that's counterintuitive, given that I said earlier that most people in the world are pro-life. What we generally see in the kind of sweep of liberalization of abortion laws is that the other side are really just much more prepared than we are, and begin planning and have much better resources for planning than we do long before we ever get to actually campaigning ourselves. And so what we found is that although, for example, most people in sub-Saharan Africa, the overwhelming majority are pro-life, they haven't needed to have a pro-life movement because it's been so obvious in their culture that abortion is a bad thing that should be restricted legally. And so while the other side is kind of mobilizing and getting kind of deep links into health ministries and other parts of African governments, the African pro-life movement hasn't mobilized yet in the same way, simply because it hasn't had to. That's what we saw in Ireland, where the pro-life movement never got started until there was actually a legal bid to overturn the law and so on. And so what we really need is, I think, especially from the US, where, as I say, you have a huge history of campaigning on this, of strategizing on this. We need people and their thoughts and their ideas and their experience really to be leaders around the world, equipping other countries, giving them the resources to be able to create pro-life leaders all around the world and to just share best practices on what an effective pro-life movement looks like. And this can take a variety of different forms. You know, we're not saying everyone has to be a major strategist. Really, these are countries where, in some of these countries, there almost is no pro-life movement at all because they haven't needed to have one. And so, in many cases, any help really would be really appreciated because we think that any small bits of help, whether helping to strategize or whether donating some money or whether doing a trip there for 2 weeks to do some teaching and education, any of these things we think can make a big difference in the abortion debate internationally. And so there are lots of different ways that people can help out, and I think it's absolutely crucial that they do so.
You know, I was in Ottawa, Canada, speaking at a pro-life rally on the grounds of the Parliament, the Canadian Parliament. And a woman came up to me. I'll never forget this. I was president of Concerned Women for America. Okay, so I'm representing America and the pro-life movement here. But Canadian women came up to me afterwards and said, "We look to America. You encourage us. You strengthen us. Please don't fall. Continue the fight in your country because you're encouraging the world." It's true, Callum, isn't that courage breeds courage. And even if that's all we do, if we stand fast here in this country, we kind of can export that, just like I'm hoping you'll export your rediscovery, the importance of free speech at college campuses. So as you look at the world then, do you see pockets where there is some strength? Do you think the rest of the world looks to America the way I just positioned it, or is that kind of distorted?
Sorry, say that last bit again.
Do you think the rest of the world does look to America? Do you think that's accurate, what I just described in Canada?
I see. Yeah, I think so. Like I said, it's so much well-resourced, so much more experienced in this. And what we found is that the pro-life movements in European countries, which have been through a similar experience, have simply not mobilized in the same way. And so they don't have the same kind of experience. They don't have the same kind of wealth of ideas and kind of abundance of the pro-life movement. And so America really is the only country that is a major international player that has a huge pro-life movement that has been going for a very long time. There's maybe an exception in Brazil or some places in Latin America. But America really is the country with so much experience and so many resources. And so I think, although there is in Western Europe, there is a sort of like aversion to the U.S., a slight kind of allergy to it, that, you know, among progressives especially, they'll just say anything from the U.S. is just horrible. And so there is a tendency to avoid being associated with some parts of the U.S. in Western Europe. On the whole, pro-lifers especially realize that actually the U.S. has contributed far more, kind of exponentially more than any other country on this topic.
Wow.
And is still in a position to do so. And so we're very grateful for that.
Dr. Callum Miller, it has been a pleasure to meet you by phone. And I think this week is going to be a great encouragement to you. It always is to me. And also the faith that you bring, your faith in Christ that you bring to your work, which we didn't even get to, I'm sure gives you the passion to fight this as it does me. Thank God for God, huh? All right, Dr. Miller, thank you so much. Sandy Rios in the morning on AFR Talk.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast
may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.